This is Ronald Reagan. Since January of 1975, when I launched my daily radio commentary, just about every conceivable issue and event affecting our nation and the world has been discussed. Not to mention a goodly number of human interest stories, personal glimpses, philosophical discourses, and even a few of what I call cleaning the desk programs, where I throw several miscellaneous items into one segment. Some people tell me these are their favorites. However, when the producer of my radio show asked that I select only 10 programs from the 800 or more I've written for inclusion in this commemorative album, I had a real problem. Sort of like picking your favorite child from a family of a dozen. Regardless, I gave the job a lot of thought and came up with a group of programs that cover a pretty broad range of subject matter. Patriotism, capitalism, conservatism, and even a touch of humor. I hope you agree with the choices I made. I know that I've used these broadcasts to criticize those who've lost faith in our system. Those who would make fundamental changes on the premise that what we've done in the past is all wrong, and those, increasing in number, who think we're over the hill and headed for the dustbin of history. Therefore, it's important every once in a while to remind ourselves of our accomplishments, lest we let someone talk us into throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I intend to go on talking about our problems, because in the main, they're problems that truly need solving. I'm also going to go on resisting those who would have us believe the problems are proof that our system isn't working. Put another way, it's time we recognize the system has never let us down. We've let the system down now and then because we're only human. Compared to the world at large, we're politically stable. A little over 3 years ago, when we had the unprecedented resignation of a president, there were no knots of people gathered on street corners, no boarding up of storefronts, no people marching in the streets or screaming sirens heralding the roundup of cabinet officers and officials. Americans just went about their business, took in a ball game, and watched their favorite TV shows. And that's why foreign money invested in America has increased about 50% in the last 5 years. Our productivity is phenomenal. We raise 37% more wheat per acre than the international average. We're 6% of the world's population on only 7% of the world's land, but we produce almost half the world's corn, 2/3 of the soybeans, 1/3 or more of the world's paper, electrical power, college graduates, and almost 1/3 of the farm machinery. Just to round it off, we make more than 2/3 of the computers and 80% of all the passenger aircraft. We lead the world in advanced technology, in telecommunications, drilling and mining equipment, medical science and agri-science. All of this is because our system freed the individual genius of man, released him to fly as high and as far as his own talent and energy would take him. We allocate resources not by government decision, but by the millions of decisions customers make when they go into the marketplace. If something seems too high priced, we buy something else. Thus, resources are steered toward those things the people want most at the price they're willing to pay. It may not be a perfect system, but it's better than any other that's ever been tried. I'm afraid you're in for a little bit of philosophizing, if you don't mind. Some of these broadcasts I must draft while I'm out on the road traveling on what I call the mashed potato circuit. A little while after I write them, for example, I'll be speaking to a group of good people in a banquet hall. Right now, however, I'm looking down on a busy city at rush hour. The streets below are twin ribbons of sparkling red and white. Tail lights on the cars moving away from my vantage point provide the red, and the headlights of those coming toward me the white. It's logical to assume all or most are homeward bound at the end of a day's work. I wonder why some social engineer hasn't tried to get them to trade homes. The traffic is equally heavy in both directions, so if they all lived in the end of town where they worked, it'd save a lot of travel time. But better forget I said that, and don't even think it, or some bureaucrat will try to do it. I wonder, though, about the people in those cars, who they are, what they do, what they're thinking about as they head for the warmth of home and family. Come to think of it, I've met them. Oh, maybe not those particular individuals, but still I feel I know them. Some social planners refer to them as the masses, which only proves they don't know them. I've been privileged to meet people all over this land in the special kind of way you meet them when you're campaigning. They are not the masses, or as the elitists would have it, the common man. They're very uncommon. individuals, each with his or her own hopes and dreams, plans and problems, and the kind of quiet courage that makes this whole country run better than just about any other place on earth. By now, thinking of their homecoming, I'm counting how many more hotel room windows I'll be looking out of before I'm in the rush hour traffic heading home. And yes, I'm feeling a little envious of the people in those cars down below. It seems I've said 1,000 goodbyes, each one harder than the one before. Someone very wise once wrote that if we were all told one day that the end was coming, that we were living our last day, every road, every street, and all the telephone lines would be jammed with people trying to reach someone to whom we wanted simply to say, I love you. But why wait for such a final day and take the chance of not getting there in time? Speaking of time, I'll have to stop now. Hello, operator. I'd like to make a long-distance call. When I read the poem of an Idaho school official a while back, I got a flood of requests to repeat it. So today I'll bring you The Superintendent's Dilemma. Sometimes I sit and ponder long about my work and life and wonder why in schools nowadays there's so much stress and strife. And then I realize the job is not like yesterday's. I'm simply flunky now for guys with the innovation craze. There's federal projects, grants and gifts, and piecemeal funding, too. It leaves no time to teach the kids and things that I should do. Operations in the schools must pass the acid test of OSHA, HU, and CLU, and all the pesky rest. There's civil rights and human rights and women's rights galore. I wonder what uncertainties the future holds in store. Boys and girls dress alike. You can't tell one from t'other. If you should need to know the sex, you'd have to ask its mother. In clothes and jobs and hair and such, you can't discriminate. It makes you wonder how a boy knows just which one to date. The high court judges see no diff between a her and him. Methinks their years are catching up. Their sight has grown too dim. Give me the good old-fashioned days when gals were gals, not men. For all that femininity, I get a kind of yen. The liberals say, don't frustrate the child with disciplined control. Just let him loose to do his thing and play his chosen role. But he'll waste time and life and limb and ruin others' lot and think he's having lots of fun on drugs and grass and pot. His right to freedom, speech, and work he'll take or leave at will, and little care for public folks who have to pay the bill. The federal help I get from Uncle, I just can't stand much more. With tax, red tape, and interest rates, I'm getting too dang poor. If you should try the federal way of deficits and debt, you'd find an IRS man looking down your neck. I'm somewhat like the school soup who tried without success to stem the tide of Fed control and all that meddling mess. They told him how to cook the lunch and how to run the school and threatened to withhold his funds if he should break the rule. He finally threw his hands up and said, I'm sick and tired of all this ruckus, do's and don'ts. I'll quit before I'm fired. And so he got a subsidized house with little rent to pay and lived on welfare's easy street, the socialistic way. The moral of this story is, if you can't buck the tide, crawl on the craft of easy life and take a leisure ride. When the public folks have had enough of all this liberal rot, they'll start to call a spade, and things will really pop. In recent years, we've been subjected to strikes by government workers, organized laborers working to unionize civil servants. In some areas, state governments have legalized collective bargaining, but collective bargaining does not prevent strikes. Let's take a look at what civil service means and what kind of a substitute it is for collective bargaining. First, public employees have a job security beyond anything private business can provide. Their boss can't sell out to another company or get old and decide to close up shop and retire. A new invention can't cancel out the market for the product they make. The boss can't go broke and declare bankruptcy. He just asks for more taxes. Public employees are protected against firing for private reasons. Promotion is based on merit, and the pay scale is ordered by law to be commensurate with the pay scale in the private sector. If government fails to abide by the law, employees can take their case to court. I believe in the right of workers to organize and to strike in private business and industry. I do not believe that public employees have the right to strike. Private and public employment are different, and no amount of propagandizing can make them the same. A strike is a test of economic strength. The worker withholds his service, management shuts down. The worker gambles loss of livelihood against his employer's ability to halt production and risk loss of customers to competitors. But government can't shut down its assembly line. Government is a monopoly. When the sewage workers in San Francisco struck and let hundreds of millions of gallons of raw sewage spill into the bay, the people of San Francisco couldn't choose to use another sewage system. When your house catches fire, you can't turn to the Yellow Pages to find a substitute for the local fire department. The same holds true when teachers or garbage collectors strike. In the case of public employees, management consists of your elected representatives. Both groups are therefore employees of the people, and management, elected officials of government, can have no power except that voluntarily granted by the people. Some have proposed using binding arbitration to settle disputes between government and employees. But how can elected representatives beholden to the people delegate to some non-elected individual or group the right to make a decision which could conceivably result in a tax increase? Where governments do not have proper procedures for hearing employee grievances, the people should tell their elected representatives to correct this. But we must make it plain we also want a law absolutely prohibiting strikes by public employees, and we demand strict enforcement of that law. If public employees do strike, then government should start recruiting new employees. One of labor's favorite presidents, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, said, "A strike of public employees manifests nothing less than an intent on their part to prevent or obstruct the operations of government until their demands are satisfied. Such action, looking toward the paralysis of government by those who have sworn to support it, is unthinkable and intolerable." That says it all. Some months ago, I told a barnyard parable that made a lot of sense with reference to matters economic. I came across it the other day. I hope you won't object if I tell it again. This is a little treatise on basic economics called The Modern Little Red Hen. Once upon a time, there was a little red hen who scratched about the barnyard until she uncovered some grains of wheat. She called her neighbors and said, "If we plant this wheat, we shall have bread to eat. Who'll help me plant it?" "Not I," said the cow. "Not I," said the duck. "Not I," said the pig. "Not I," said the goose. "Then I will," said the little red hen, and she did. The wheat grew tall and ripened into golden grain. "Who will help me reap my wheat?" asked the little red hen. "Not I," said the duck. "Out of my classification," said the pig. "I'd lose my seniority," said the cow. "I'd lose my unemployment compensation," said the goose. "Then I will," said the little red hen. And she did. At last it came time to bake the bread. "Who will help me bake bread?" asked the little red hen. "Well, that would be overtime for me," said the cow. "I'd lose my welfare benefits," said the duck. "I'm a dropout and never learned how," said the pig. "Well, if I'm to be the only helper, that's discrimination," said the goose. "Then I will," said the little red hen. She baked 5 loaves and held them up for her neighbors to see. They all wanted some, and in fact demanded a share. But the little red hen said, "No, I can eat the 5 loaves myself." "Excess profits," cried the cow. "Capitalist leech," screamed the duck. "I demand equal rights," yelled the goose. And the pig just grunted. And they painted unfair picket signs and marched round and round the little red hen, shouting obscenities. When the government agent came, he said to the little red hen, "You must not be greedy." "But I earned the bread," said the little red hen. "Exactly," said the agent. "That's the wonderful free enterprise system. Anyone in the barnyard can earn as much as he wants. But under our modern government regulations, the productive workers must divide their product with the idle." And they lived happily ever after, including the little red hen, who smiled and clucked, "I am grateful, I am grateful." But her neighbors wondered why she never again baked any more bread.